Before I begin, I want to let all of you know that are of university age. If you're a university student here at Andrews or are simply in that age bracket, regardless of what you do during the week, I want you to know that you are invited to come to Nikki's for lunch today. And you may think, well, you are making a major point of a minor announcement. This is not true. This is not true. Hundreds of people go to Nikki's for lunch. This is a great place for great food and great fellowship for all of our university age crowd. So let's see. Those of you that know how to get to Nikki's house, would you raise your hand? Okay, those of you that don't know, keep your hands up, keep your hands up. Those of you that don't know, look at somebody whose hand is raised, and after the service today, go up to them and say, hey, how do I get to Nikki's house? Okay, and that way you'll be sure and have lunch. I'm going to be there, what do we think, 2:30-ish, I think is what we're looking at over at Nikki's place. Come and see us. This is a great way. Many thanks to those of you that support financially our ministry to our young adults. This is but one of the many things where that money goes to help. Welcome to part two of our continuing series entitled A Reason to Believe. I am, of course, glad that all of you are here. I'm particularly glad if you consider yourself to be a skeptic, an agnostic, an atheist. Thank you for being here. I understand going to a church is not necessarily top of your list most of the time. So thank you for being here. And if you're watching online with this, either live or recording later, and you're a skeptic as well, thank you. Thank you for being here and being willing to come with an open mind to talk about these very, very important questions. Now, in part one, it was a little while ago, and if you weren't here, or if you just are forgetting some things, let me very briefly tell you a little bit about where we went in part one. In part one, we looked at two potent, compelling, and reasonable arguments as to the existence of God. Argument number one was that there is something rather than nothing. It was the Sahara Surprise. A place that doesn't look like it has any evidence of a creator God actually does, because there is something there. There are grains of sand rather than just nothing. We looked at cosmology, we looked at the Big Bang, we looked at a number of things, and we came to the conclusion that there cannot be an infinite regression of causes. At some point in the past, there is someone who doesn't need a beginning, someone who's been there all along, who gets everything rolling, who lights the fuse on that Big Bang, and that person is God. We also looked at a second compelling argument, and that's the argument from design. It is rational, it is reasonable to believe when you see design that there is a designer. When we look at the incredible complexity of nature that we see around us today, the odds of that happening by random mutation and chance over long periods of time is essentially no different from zero. Creation has the fingerprints of a creator God all over it. It is reasonable to believe, looking at the complexity, the design that we see in nature, that a creator is behind it. Which brings us to today. Take a look, please, in your Bible at Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. Habakkuk chapter 1, page 631 in the Red Bible, which is hopefully somewhere near where you're sitting right now. Now, as I mentioned in part one, if you're a skeptic, if you do not believe in God, you may question why it is that I'm immediately going to this book, which you may or may not have any respect for. As I said then, hang with me, because I think you're going to see why it is that I refer to the Bible here. It turns out that the question we're going to tackle today is a very ancient one, and the Bible here frames it exceedingly well. Habakkuk was a prophet, lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago, a prophet of God, and so here he is speaking essentially to his boss, to God, and this is what he says. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Ever felt that way? You know, much as in Habakkuk's day, the problem of evil looms large in our day. Even as I speak, there are innocent babies being killed. There are innocent people being tortured. There are wars taking place. There are innocent people that are being destroyed, tortured, oppressed in a thousand different ways all over the planet. And many a person has become a skeptic because they look at all of this evil in the world today, the seemingly random, inexplainable evil, and they say, well, there cannot be a God. If that's the way the world is, then there is no God. There's just us. Many years ago, David Hume, an 18th century Scottish skeptic, philosopher, and empiricist, saw this particular challenge, and this is how he worded it. Is he, meaning God, willing to prevent evil, but not able? Then he is impotent, meaning not all-powerful. Is he able, but not willing? Then he is malevolent, which means he wants to harm people. Is he both willing and able? Why then is there evil? This is a serious topic that deserves serious attention. And in my personal experience, too often theists, that is believers in God, will just bounce over this one, sometimes particularly Christians. I mean, it's not that they deny that there's evil in the world, but they say, well, I just trust God. I just believe, leaving our atheist friends to marvel at our apparent lack of compassion and reasoning ability. I would suggest that the theist must give reasonable and compelling answers to the challenge that the presence of evil in the world represents. Now, as usual, the mind can absorb only what the seat can endure, so I do not have time to treat this exhaustively today, but we will make at least a good start. I'm a Christian theist. So what is a Christian theist's response to this challenge of evil in the world today? Well, two initial things. Number one, the presence of evil in the world is not an argument about whether or not God exists, but rather is an argument about what kind of God exists. Now, this is very important. I've talked to a number of skeptics over the years. I've read fairly widely on this topic. Often this gets missed. It is true. There is tremendous evil in the world today. Wickedness, oppression, etc., 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 seemingly ad infinitum, right? But that is not an argument about whether or not God exists. It's simply an argument about what kind of God exists. Maybe God is just a jerk. But the presence of evil has nothing to do with whether or not there is a God. This, incidentally, is why Habakkuk, the prophet whose words we read just a few moments ago, he is complaining bitterly about the presence of evil in the world, and he directs his complaint to God. Because Habakkuk realized the presence of this unexplained evil does not disallow the existence of God. Now, secondly, there is a question that simply begs to be asked of my atheist and agnostic friends, and here it is. On what basis does the evil in the world offend you? Why do you think it's wrong? Now, notice carefully here. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with your conclusion at this point, but I am asking you, why do you feel that evil in the world is wrong? And some of you are thinking, well, are you crazy? How could you even ask the question? Of course, evil and suffering of innocent people, particularly in the world, is wrong. Anyone can see that. To which I would respond, are you sure? Can anyone really see that evil in the world is wrong? I would gently suggest that the wrongness of evil in the world is not as readily explainable as you may think. Let me read something to you here that will illustrate this. I don't normally read lengthier passages here from books, but I'm going to read about two pages here in this book. It's called The Reason for God, subtitle Belief in an Age of Skepticism. It's by Timothy Keller. This is a New York Times bestseller. This is not a book that was written in a closet somewhere. This has been published far and wide. Timothy Keller was a Christian. He was a minister, I believe, in New York City. And in the process of many, many years of doing work there, he encountered many, many atheists and skeptics of various degrees, etc. And he thoroughly enjoyed his time, and he learned a great deal. On one particular day, a couple came to him for some advice, and let me read to you about this. Timothy Keller says, "In many cases, I have to put on my philosophy professor hat in order to be a good pastor to people. A young couple once came to me for some spiritual direction. They, quote, didn't believe in much of anything, they said. How could they begin to figure out if there even was a God? So I asked them to tell me about something they felt was really, really wrong. The woman immediately spoke out against the practices that marginalized women. I said I agreed with her fully, since I was a Christian who believed God made all human beings, but I was curious why she thought it was wrong. She responded, women are human beings, and human beings have rights. It is wrong to trample on someone's rights. I asked her how she knew that. Puzzled, she said, well, everyone knows it's wrong to violate the rights of someone, I said. I said, well, most people in the world actually don't know that. They don't have a Western view of human rights. Imagine if someone said to you, everyone knows that women are inferior. You'd say, that's not an argument, that's just an assertion. And you'd be right. So let's start again, I said. If there is no God, as you believe, and everyone has just evolved from animals, why would it be wrong to trample on someone's rights? Her husband responded, yes, it is true. We are just bigger-brained animals, but I'd say animals have rights too. You shouldn't trample on their rights either. I asked whether he held animals guilty for violating the rights of other animals if the stronger ones ate the weaker ones. No, he said, I couldn't do that. So he only held human beings guilty if they trampled on the weak? Yes, he said. Why this double standard, I asked. Why did the couple insist that human beings had to be different from animals so that they were not allowed to act as was natural to the rest of the animal world? Why did the couple keep insisting that humans had this great, unique individual dignity and worth? Why did they believe in human rights? I don't know, the woman said. I guess they are just there, that's all. The conversation was much more congenial than this very compressed account conveys. The young couple laughed at the weakness of some of their responses, which showed me that they were open to exploration, and that encouraged me to be more pointed than I would ordinarily have been. However, this conversation reveals how our culture differs from all others that have gone before. People today still have strong moral convictions, but unlike people in other times and places, they don't have any visible basis for why they find some things to be evil and some things good. It's almost like their moral intuitions are free-floating in mid-air, far off the ground. So let's note this couple's challenge. On the one hand, they, like so many people in society today, could easily be considered moral relativists. Now, you understand what moral relativism is. That moral relativism is the belief that you can have your morality and I can have my understanding of morality. And even if what we think is right and wrong are 180 degrees out from one another, that's okay. Because moral relativism says that truth is relative to the observer. Furthermore, they say truth changes. It migrates from, you know, time and place and this culture. Truth contains no absolutes. And by the way, that is absolutely true. Those of you that missed that philosophical sleight of hand need to go back and listen to that part of the sermon again. It will keep you thinking throughout all of potluck today, okay? So, on the one hand, they are moral relativists, kind of making it up as they go along according to their own understanding. And yet, on the other hand, they are making bold, definitive statements about what is right and what is wrong. So, let's see if we can make some sense of this. Let's take up the challenge that this couple offers to us. It is the challenge of human rights. Okay. For many, many decades now, and probably considerably longer, there has been an ongoing crisis about this idea of human rights amongst world leaders, many of whom have embraced secular atheistic philosophy. They want to know the answers to some genuinely important questions, such as, are there universal human rights? Secondly, if so, how do we know what they are? And thirdly, how far can we go in enforcing them? Those are good questions. And finding a proper basis for human rights is thus no small deal. Millions of people will be affected by those leaders' conclusions. So, what is the basis for human rights? Well, it may surprise you to know that the possible answers to that question are relatively few in number. Now, to be clear, if you go online and you Google, you know, bases for human rights, there'll be all kinds of things that will come up. But if you distill them down, there are essentially three major ones that rise to the surface. The first basis that's proposed for the basis for human rights from many secular sources, from skeptical sources, is because I said so. Now you laugh and giggle, and I get it, I understand, but you must understand, I'm not trying to be funny here. This is true. Because I said so. In other words, these leaders are saying, I think that such and such an activity, experience, etc. is wrong, therefore it should not happen to me or to other people, and on that basis, human rights are to be created. Now let's be careful here. Before we chuckle too much, let's admit that many Christians have similarly flimsy reasons for their moral decisions too. Okay? So we're not immune to this. Now, this basis for moral values, for human rights, is popular in public and entertainment discourse today. Politicians and Hollywood figures will make grand human rights statements that will have essentially nothing to back their conclusions up except, well, because I said so. Okay? And these kinds of one-person-centered declarations have been happening for years. Ravi Zacharias, in his book, The End of Reason, describes the 1948 debate between Frederick Copleston, who was a priest and a philosopher, in other words, a believer in God, and Bertrand Russell, noted skeptic and atheistic philosopher. Now, if you're an atheist and you've studied academically in that field, the name Bertrand Russell is familiar to you. Even to this day, Bertrand Russell is considered to be one of the top atheistic intellectuals of the 20th century. So Copleston, the believer, and Russell, the atheist, had a televised debate. It was in 1948. It was broadcast on the BBC, and at first, of course, it became a national sensation, later on an international one. Here is how Ravi Zacharias describes it. When Copleston, that's the believer, asked Bertrand Russell, the skeptic, how he differentiated between good and bad, Russell answered, "I don't have any justification any more than I have when I distinguish between blue and yellow. I can see they are different." Okay, so what Russell is saying here is that I see it. It's my understanding, boom, it's there, okay? "Well, that is an excellent justification. I agree," said Copleston. "You distinguish blue and yellow by seeing them. So you distinguish good and bad by what faculty?" Now you see what he's asking here. He says, okay, I agree. You can tell the difference between yellow and blue by this faculty, your vision. You can see with your eyes, right? So by what faculty then do you just know the difference between right and wrong? Here is what Russell said. "By my feelings," was Russell's reply. That is what he said. Again, considered to be one of the towering intellectual giants of the 20th century. That is what his response was. "By my feelings." Now, Zacharias picks up the story. He says, "Father Copleston was kind. The next question was staring Russell in the face, but wasn't asked because he," meaning Russell, "already looked so weak in that part of the discussion." In other words, Copleston did not want to further embarrass Russell. "The question that should have been asked was, 'Mr. Russell, in some cultures they love their neighbor, in other cultures they eat them. Do you have a personal preference? And if so, what is it?'" It is crystal clear that because I said so is a woefully inadequate basis on which to declare that all humans have certain rights, that this is wrong, that that is right, etc., etc. People's personal opinions are simply too variable and at times far too simplistic to be a basis for determining human rights and what is right and wrong. Now, many secular thinkers have realized the weakness of because I said so. And so they have tried to make it a little more palatable, a little more strident by saying that human rights are determined not because I say so, but because we say so. Now, again, this is not a joke. This is true. And honestly, particularly for people that live in democratic countries, there is some kind of innate appeal here. In other words, they are saying the majority of society, and that will vary from society to society, might be a majority of Congress in one country or parliament or just people in general, etc. The majority of people together, we determine that we have human rights, what those rights are, and how to enforce them. That is a stable basis for human rights. Basically, it's the democratization of human rights, of morality. But even a moment of reasonable reflection reveals that this argument crashes onto the same rock as the first because I said so argument, and we can see that this is so by asking a simple question. What if the majority decides it is not in their interest to grant human rights? What if the majority says, well, we're going to grant human rights for us, but not for this particular minority? And think carefully. Has that ever happened? Yeah. We'll talk more about that shortly. But for now, notice this. If human rights are simply created by the majority, then they are no longer, technically speaking, rights. For a genuine human right is a right whether the majority realizes it or not. Now, in light of this, a third path has been chosen by some secular thinkers. And they have said that human rights are derived from the essential nature of humanity. Now, I confess, years ago, when I first began to look into these things, this definitely had some appeal to me. It was kind of like almost like a gut impulse. Oh, well, yeah, I can see some merit in that there. In other words, this group is saying, just look at humanity. The birth of a child, the wonder of life. If you look at these things, they say, you must conclude that people naturally deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And again, part of me gets this, and part of me wants to kind of agree with that. But please listen carefully. For atheism, such a basis for human rights is impossible. You say, why? Well, again, follow me carefully here because this could get mildly complicated. The reason atheism cannot look at nature, humanity is a part of nature. The reason atheism cannot look at nature and say, aha, nature itself declares human rights, is because the overwhelming majority of atheists believe in evolutionary theory. Charles Darwin here, the father of evolutionary theory. And my guess is many of you are familiar with evolutionary theory. Let me just give you a nutshell definition. Evolutionary theory is the belief that the diversity of species we see today on the planet is not the result of anything done by a creator God, but rather by random mutations over long periods of time. That's at the core of evolutionary theory. Random mutations over long periods of time. Now, why is this important to recognize? Because evolutionary theory emphatically denies the possibility of human rights. And why does it deny the possibility of human rights? Because evolution, by definition, is a value-less process. It is the destruction of the weak by the strong. It is the survival of the fittest. And notice carefully, human beings are simply the most recent development of this random, unguided, purposeless process. We are simply more advanced amoebas. So if evolutionary theory is true, There is no such thing as evil or good, much less natural human rights. There instead can only be survival. And again, through the eyes of evolutionary theory, humans are essentially just collections of random chemicals responding to environmental stimuli, the result of millions of years of random, undirected, unguided change. And therefore, evolution offers no universal standard for determining what is right, what is moral, what is immoral. And if, for instance, one living thing dominates or tortures or kills another living thing, that is not evil, it just is. But this immediately brings us to a profound contradiction, does it not? Nearly every rank and file atheist agrees that evil does exist. That there really are some things in the world that are genuinely evil. We may disagree around the table as to what those things are, but that they exist, that some things are genuinely evil. They almost all of them agree. But hold on. If you believe that there are no moral standards in nature, but you still believe morality exists, there is only one other reasonable conclusion. Morality exists because there is a universal standard outside of nature. It's the only other rational conclusion. You see, here is the reasonable progression. Let me put it on the screen here for you. Number one, when you assert that there is such a thing as evil, you must assume there is such a thing as good. Does that make sense? Right, because these phrases mean something. These words mean something. If you're going to say that there's evil, you are contrasting it with something else, namely that which is good. Okay. Number two, when you say there is such a thing as good, you must assume there is a moral law that enables you to tell the difference between good and evil. There must be some objective standard by which to determine which is which. Does that make sense? Okay. I see nodding heads. Okay. Which brings us to number three. When you assume a moral law, you must also assume that there is a moral law giver, the source of the moral law. In other words, objective morality comes only from God. Now, if you are a studied skeptic, you may immediately be thinking, okay, but that's not necessarily the God of the Bible, to which I would say, okay, but I think there is some evidence for that. But even if I grant that, this little study that we've just done of morality, reason requires that there be an intelligent being, that being be outside of nature, because we can't find it inside of nature. Evolutionary theory forbids it. There's only one other rational choice, and that is God as the source of morality. And with this in mind, we can now see three very important things. Please listen carefully. Number one, atheists, when protesting against evil, are actually borrowing from theism and mostly from Christianity. They are showing they believe at least partly in the very thing, namely God, they claim to have disproven. Number two, atheists do not have to believe in God to live moral lives. I've had some atheist acquaintances come back, you're saying I have to be a Christian or be a moral person. That's not true. I give to charity and say I'm a good person. I am so glad that there are atheists that are good citizens. I am glad to not be shot by atheists when I walk across the street. This is a good thing, okay? But if atheists do live moral lives, it is either because of coincidence or because they have chosen to live better than the amorality atheism logically calls for. And number three is a heavy one. If there is no God, then there is no objective moral framework by which to make genuinely meaningful life decisions. But without genuinely meaningful life decisions, life itself has no meaning. Without God, therefore, there is no overarching reason to live except in one's imagination. And I don't mean that as an insult. That is the only reasonable conclusion. In other words, you may believe that you can find meaning in life without God. But as we have just seen, such a belief is not reasonable. You do not have good reasons for your belief, and so it is instead simply your imagination that says it is so. Many people accuse Christians of having their head in the clouds and believing in fairy tales. Could it be that the accusation of living in imagination goes two ways? Now, atheists that I have had personal conversations with over the years, many times these are lengthy conversations, and I appreciate them, by the way. I think the longest I ever went was just over 4 hours in there. These are important questions, and I enjoy the opportunity to sit with and to talk about these things. In my personal conversations with skeptics and atheists over the years, two responses have come back to me when they see particularly this third point. First of all, some have begun to reconsider the propaganda that they have been fed by those advocating atheism as a valuable way of life. I mean, if you go online today, there are many atheists that claim that atheism is the ultimate freedom. I mean, there is no God. There's no moral law. You can do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it. It's the ultimate freedom. And as it turns out, it's actually an instant path to meaninglessness, even as every fiber of our being cries out that life must mean something. And by the way, that just gut sense that life is supposed to mean something, to me, that's part of the fingerprints of God. I quoted in part one from the Bible in the book of Acts, where it says, in him, meaning in God, we live and move and have our being. In other words, God's marks are everywhere. You can deny him, but nature itself declares that he exists if you are willing to see. That's the first response. But a second response, and I confess I've not gotten this one as much because the cost of it is so high. A second response that some strident atheists will say back to me in looking at this, you know, the meaninglessness of life, they will say this in essence: yes, life is meaningless, so deal with it. They say, deal with it by avoiding as much pain as you can while getting as much pleasure as you can. Make what brings you pleasure your source of meaning in your life. And I tell you know what? It almost has a utilitarian ring to it, right? You can always know what's right. Does it make you happy? Does it bring you pleasure, right? If it doesn't, don't do it. Avoid it. If it does, pursue it, right? But hear it and hear it well. The reality is, and it's been proven billions of times over, is that those who try to make their own pleasure the source of meaning in their life, they fail miserably. Ask any therapist alive today. It is a mental health fact that those who are deeply concerned with their own pleasure live some of the most meaningless lives possible. And one reason for this is because you can never have enough. No matter how much money you get, for instance, it is never enough. There's always someone who's got more than you do. You always could use just a little bit more. No matter how much physical pleasure you have, it's never enough. People have risked their lives for more, one last ounce of physical pleasure. No matter how much power you get, it is never enough, because pleasure is fundamentally temporary. And therefore, it is incapable of bringing any long-lasting meaning into our lives. And those who try to live by it will only find themselves progressively drowning, not in meaning, but in meaninglessness. Sadly, many who have attempted to deal with the meaninglessness of life through seeking their own pleasure have ultimately ended up ending their own lives. Or they have simply died of natural causes while being miserable. Or, and I'm completely serious about this, they have ended the lives of millions of others. See, what do you mean? Ended the lives of millions of others? Yes, millions of others. Notice this. I have heard it, maybe you've heard it as well if you're a theist, if you're a Christian. Many times skeptics, particularly publicly, I'm not going to name the most prominent atheists in society today, you can find that out for yourself. But they will charge religion with incredible cruelty. They say one of the reasons why we should not be religious, why we should not believe in God, is because of all of the heinous crimes against humanity that have been committed in the name of religion. Now, there is some truth to this. The Crusades, for instance. The Crusades, Christians taking up the sword to do evangelism, right? If you don't agree with me, off with your head, right? It was awful. It was terrible. It should never have happened. But when my skeptic friends point this out and stop there, they're only telling a portion of the story. And they show a sad form of historical amnesia because it is atheism that has driven the incredible slaughters of the last 115 years, not theism and certainly not Christianity. Pol Pot in Cambodia killed at least 20% of the entire Cambodian population. Stalin in Russia killed at least 15 million. Hitler, a huge fan of Friedrich Nietzsche, the godfather of modern atheism, killed more than 6 million Jews and millions of others in the Allied forces. And all of these slaughters were built explicitly on atheistic ideals and values, not Christian ones. So yes, it is true. Christians have slaughtered others to force them to comply with Christianity. But when Christians do that, they are in violation of this book. Because my Bible tells me to love my enemies, not kill them. Pray for those who persecute you, etc., etc., etc. Christians have done that, but they do it in violation of Christian principle. Atheists, on the other hand, when they have slaughtered their millions, they are simply following their beliefs to its logical conclusion. Survival of the fittest, after all, right? The strong can do whatever they wish with the weak. Just a bag of chemicals, after all. All of which brings us to some final questions. I am a Christian theist. What is a Christian theist's response to the problem of evil in the world? What does the Bible have to say about the existence of evil? Can the presence of evil be compatible with an all-loving, all-powerful God? In a word, yes. And let me just briefly share with you two responses here. There are more than this, but time prevents from dealing with all of them, so very quickly. The first response that I would offer is this. Love requires the option to reject love. Love is not love if you are forced to accept it. We know this to be true. Anybody who's had children knows this to be true. Anybody who's watched children, if you're a school teacher, if you've ever seen kids, when children are itty-bitty, there is a measure of benevolent, if you will, force that needs to be used. If they are about to grab a burner on a hot stove, you should reach out and restrain them, okay? But there comes a time when if you truly love your children, you will not do that any longer. Well, maybe with the burner on the stove, you might still do that. But moral decisions, there comes a point, maybe it's mid-teens, maybe it's late teens, early young adults, whatever the age is in your particular environment. There comes a point where if you truly love them, you will not try to force their hand. Because you love them, instead, you will let them choose. Because love to be love must have the option to not choose to love. And a God of love is under the same thing. You know, there are entire books that have been written about just this one point. If you're a skeptic listening right now, let it sink in, please. Take this seriously. This matters. This is solid ground. And secondly, a Christian theist's second response to evil is the cross of Christ. You say, what? What's that about? If you're a skeptic, perhaps you've heard about the cross and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Maybe you haven't, so let me just explain briefly. The Bible says that God is love. Shortest definition that we have of who God is. God is the essence and the definition and the foundation of all that is love. He's the foundation of all that is true, the Bible talks about. Well, in the beginning, God wanted to share his love and his truth. And so the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and humanity. And when he created humanity and the earth that he lived in at that time, all was perfect, all was good. There was no war, can you imagine? No war, no fighting, no selfishness. Everything was perfect. Love ruled the day. But love
to be love requires the option to choose to not love. And there came a time when humanity decided to not love. And because God gives human beings free moral agency, they were allowed to make the choice. A change came over the world. It happened pretty quickly. Nature itself was affected, and the human heart, perhaps most of all. Choosing to not love is what the Bible calls a sin. And our sin separated us from God. Now keep in mind, he did not want this. But the nature of God, the goodness of God, if you cross that, it's not that God is waiting there to hit you with the fly swatter. It's the very nature of things. If you break a stick over your knee, you now have two pieces, not one, no matter how much you wish it was still one. And so God was separated from his creation, and it pained him. And the result of that separation for humanity was death. We see this all around us today, don't we? Our world is one where death and dying happen all too often. And it started back then with those sins and continues because of sin today. But God loves people. He loves me and he loves you. And it was unacceptable for him to leave this gap between us. But he couldn't cheat. Someone had to pay the price for that death. And so God did what none of us expected him to do. Jesus Christ came down from heaven and became a human being, fully God, fully man. Don't ask me to explain that. It's a mystery. I don't know how. Fully God and fully man. This divine human being came here, first century AD, and he was born in Bethlehem as a human being is born, and he felt all that we have to feel, our pain, our discomfort, all of those things. He ate with us. He walked with us. He slept under the same stars as his disciples did as they traveled about Palestine there. And at the end, after teaching about his kingdom of love and how to restore love and overcome evil, he again did what no one expected. He allowed himself to be crucified on a Roman cross. He gave up his life willingly, and he died as a substitute for me dying for my sins and you dying for yours. And when Jesus did that, something happened. Time itself was divided, even to this day. And death began to work backwards. Anyone who accepts that substitution, Jesus' death on behalf of their own, receives at least two things. Number one, their guilt is removed. They are forgiven. Guilt is a huge problem in our world today. There are people that are driven by guilt day after day. Whether they're believers in God or not, their guilt drives them. But in Jesus Christ, it's erased. It's taken away. You're set free. And secondly, you receive the power from Jesus Christ to become the person that deep in your inmost soul you always knew you could be. A person of love, of justice, of mercy, of dignity, of honor, and respect. You know, there are still some things about evil that I don't claim to be able to explain on this planet. But I do find God's wisdom echoed in the words of, again, Timothy Keller. In the same book, he said this. He said, let's see where this has brought us. If we again ask the question, why does God allow evil and suffering to continue? And we look at the cross of Jesus, we still do not know what the answer is. However, we now know what the answer isn't. It can't be that he doesn't love us. It can't be that he is indifferent or detached from our condition. God takes our misery and suffering so seriously that he was willing to take it on himself. And in taking our misery and our suffering and our sins on himself, we find the healing that humanity so desperately needs today. As the Bible boldly proclaims in Isaiah 53, verse 5, by his wounds we are healed. You see, as it turns out, it is not enough, however valuable it may be, it is not enough to know the truth about what is good and what is evil. We must also have hope. Hope that promises us the power to overcome the evil in the world and to embrace the good. Hope that promises to change us from the inside out. Hope that enables us again to become the people that we've always dreamed we could be. This is what the world needs today. And this is what Jesus on the cross provides. In fact, maybe you've seen the text at a football game or some other sporting event. It's probably the most famous text in all of the Bible, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. This is why Christian theism, in spite of numerous attempts to snuff it out, has endured for 2,000 years. It offers a hope that is based in a living being, a person who not only died, but rose from the grave. And if you're a skeptic and you hear those words and you say, yeah, right, guess what? Come back next week, and our entire time will be spent talking about that very reasonable event. I hope to see you then.